Good morning, everyone. We've got a couple of announcements before we start. Better give them now because otherwise we'll forget. Norman has something to share.
Yes, there's going to be a reading at the Unity Pavilion next Sunday. It's at 6 o'clock. There's going to be food at 6, and the reading starts at 7:30. And the reading is about Sri Aurobindo's passing. It's the text from Nirod's Baron's book, and there are a number of readers. I think there are 4 of us. So please do come along. The only thing is you've got to register. There's a limited amount, I think it's 70, and I think the places are going quite quickly. So you've got to register, and you've got to register at aspiration@oroville.org.in if you want to come. It's next week, next Sunday.
So that means registering for food and for the
food
reading.
For food and the reading, yes.
It's announced in the news and notes, I think.
Yeah. It has been announced, yes.
Norman thought it of interest
think,
to some
yes.
of the people who are here. That's why he wanted to share it. And I've got a couple of things to share. Here's the second part of English of Savitri. I received the copies on 18th afternoon. So I just have a few copies here, and they are on sale in our information desk. This volume covers the Book of the Divine Mother, and it costs 450 rupees. And I've just got a couple of copies here. And the other thing that I'm sharing is our appeal. The construction of the Sangam Hall has started. It's going on quite fast. I think Helmut's quite happy with the speed that it's moving along. So but that we also need a good inflow of funds. So
can you say a little bit about what that is?
The Sangam Hall. Actually, it's been a part of our master plan since the very beginning. And Lakshmi Narayan, who's one of our founder members, always thought that it should be the first thing, that what we need is a hall where we sit and gather like this to read Savitri. Now, of course, we are only usually maximum 40 or 45 people. But this Sangam Hall is designed to hold about 200 plus. And we'll also be using it for the Om Choir. And it's not like the amphitheater. It's not open air. It's covered. And we've been encouraged that we should aim for air conditioning. And it will also have a multimedia facility that we can do projections. So the lectures can be there, different kinds of events. And we've started the construction now, and we're aiming to have it ready by the end of November, November 24th, 2017. So please take a leaflet and as you go out, and you can just keep them on the table. See how you can help.
But what does Sangam mean?
Sangam, it means the community of like-minded people. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Togetherness.
Togetherness, yes.
The literal meaning is the confluence of two rivers.
Ah, yes, the joining, coming together.
Different rivers.
So this would be where we come together for around Savitri.
Thank you.
J'en avais d'ailleurs deux questions. Friday, il y a une conférence in this place. Somebody tell me, is registered this conference.
Which conference?
Friday, you know, from Ashram. Come in the mail about Surrender.
On Surrender in Savitri.
In
yes.
Savitri.
Yes.
Is registered.
Recorded, I think.
It was recorded, and Manohar has made a film.
Okay, thank you.
It's ready. I have to find a way to send it to you because, again, also with this USB doesn't support.
It doesn't support.
So we have to find on an hard drive that gets Mac. But it's ready, it's done, it's already available.
Okay, somebody come in yesterday and.
No, we will, as usual, try to make a booklet with the text of the talk and the film.
Yes.
is marvelous.
It's very nice.
There was a bit on the other because if I can say, because it was a bit longer than you and I had a battery, which is about 68 minutes. So I said, okay. It finished just last second of the 60. The last second when he said amen, that was finished. That was a bit of miracles.
How nice. How nice. Yes, he talked a little bit longer.
Yeah, I said, no, if you can, I don't have the time to change the battery, it will be finished anyhow, and what is it, the lecture without the last words. Then the last word, amen, came out.
Okay.
Thank you.
So today, last week, we finished reading book 8, I think. And now we are moving on to part 3 of Savitri. This is books 9, 10, 11, and 12. Last week I mentioned that book 8 was the part of the poem which Sri Aurobindo revised least. It is very, very close to the earliest version that we know from 1916. And in that very early version, that was divided into two parts. In the earliest version, he didn't give them names, but in the next version, he divided them into, he gave names to these two parts. The first part was called Earth, and the second part was called Beyond. And they were roughly the same size in the first version. So Sri Aurobindo has mentioned this in a letter, that the first version was in these two parts of Earth and Beyond. And then he changed it into three parts. So actually this third part that we're embarking on now corresponds to that second part of the earliest version, the part that was Beyond. Everything else that we've read so far was in the first part about Earth. But of course, it was this first part that Sri Aurobindo expanded most, particularly that part which has become part 1, books 1, 2, and 3. There he's done an enormous expansion over about 14 years. He doesn't seem to have attended to any other part of the book. He only worked on book 1. And this is the part about which he has said that I wasn't thinking of Savitri as a work to be finished and shared. I was using it as a means of ascension for myself in my yoga. That every time I was able to reach a higher level of consciousness, I turned to the poem and saw how I could lift up what was in the poem to that higher level. So he went on doing that until it seems about 1944. And only then, 1944 or 45, he seems to have decided that after all, this poem can be finished and can be shared, and he started preparing certain parts of it for publication. They were published in little fascicles or in articles in Ashram journals. And then he started working on completing the rest of the poem. So there too, he did a big expansion in 1946. He added completely a new element which hadn't been there before, which is the Book of Yoga, which we finished reading recently. Book of Savitri's Yoga. And then, as I said, book 8 is relatively little revised. And now we're starting in book 9. And here too, in book 9, and in one or two places in book 10, we find whole clumps of lines that are there in the very, very first version. So he was going back, taking the old material and
weaving it in, adding new things, sometimes changing just one word or two in a line to lift it up to that higher level that he was aiming at for the whole poem. So we can keep that in mind as we read
now. What stage Nirodh Dah came into picture?
At 1945, I believe. Maybe he was helping already before then, but I think he, in his book, he mentions that it's from 1945 that the dictation was taken. And this is from book four onwards. So in his book, 12 Years with Sri Aurobindo, there's a chapter on Savitri, and there he's mentioned a little bit. He says, my memory is not good. With Amal's help, I've done some research. But so far as we can reconstruct, this is how the composition of the poem went on after that.
So he was dictating that it's not going through the old version, he's starting new, the lines are coming new?
No, he was starting on the basis of the old version.
Mm-hmm.
Nirodh would read,
yeah.
And Sri Aurobindo had an amazing memory.
Mm-hmm.
No? And perhaps the next morning he would start to dictate or to make changes. But it is an amazing feat, and how many lines he has added at that time. And of course, there in the Sri Aurobindo archives, many, many different manuscripts are gathered, and the expert who has gone through them to a certain extent is Richard Hartz, who came here and gave us a very interesting talk on the composition. Actually, he came twice. And he's written a series of articles in Mother India, which is called The Composition of Savitri, which traces to a certain extent how the new developments came in. But he hasn't been able to complete that. He left it uncompleted when other work came up. So I think it would be worthwhile, before we launch into the reading of Canto 1 of Book 9, just again to look at the 18 lines which Sri Aurobindo added, apparently in the late 1940s, to make a link between this unrevised, otherwise unrevised Book 8 and the rest of the poem as he had it at that time in his mind.
What page is it?
It starts on page 565, line 153 to the end. Would you read, Sonia?
I'm afraid you have to give me the line because I have no idea.
Something had come there, conscious, vast, and dire. It's about halfway down the page.
Something had come there, conscious, vast and dark. Near her she felt a silent shade, immense, chilling the moon with darkness for its back. An awful hush had fallen upon the place. There was no cry of birds, no voice of beasts. A terror and an anguish filled the world, as if annihilation's mystery had taken a sensible form. A cosmic mind looked out on all from formidable eyes, contemning all with its unbearable gaze, and with immortal lips and a vast brow, it saw its immense destroying thought, all things and beings as a pitiful dream, rejecting with calm disdain nature's delight, the wordless meaning of its deep regard, voicing the unreality of things and life that would be forever but never more, and its brief and vain recurrence without cease, as if a
tradition, we are told that the moment when Satyavan dies was the hottest hour, the hottest day, the hottest month of the year. Here, Shobindo shows the effect of this coming of the presence of death, this character in the poem that he calls death. The first effect is of an immense cloud, a huge shadow darkening and chilling the noon, the hottest time. It becomes cold and dark. And all the beautiful birds and the rustling in the woods and all that, it has fallen completely silent. There was no cry of birds, no voice of beasts. And more than that, there's this sense of terror and anguish. It's something at which the being revolts. That feeling seems to fill the whole world. It's as if the mystery of annihilation, that things could cease to exist, could become nothing. It had taken on a sensible form, a form which can be perceived by the senses. And then Shobindo characterizes it as a cosmic mind. It's something on the scale of the whole universe, a consciousness on the scale of the whole universe. And it's looking out at everything with these formidable eyes, powerful, terrifying eyes. And it looks at everything with this unbearable gaze, contemning everything. It is despising everything, looking at everything with contempt.
What is the basis of this death?
Hmm?
What is the basis of this contempt? Why is he sees it all?
He's looking at it all and saying, this is all unreal. I am the only reality. And I contemn all this to nothingness. Basically, that's what he said. It has no right really to exist. It's all an illusion. So there's something can be seen, the cosmic mind can be perceived, and we can see eyes, immortal eyes, vast brow, and this cosmic being, this mind, this consciousness. Its thought has a power of destruction. In its immense destroying thought, it saw all things and beings as a pitiful dream. It rejects all the delight of nature from a great height with disdain, from a superior height. It looks down on all this and says, nonsense. The look in those eyes, the wordless meaning of its deep regard, the way that the consciousness is looking at everything in the universe, is voicing, expressing the unreality of things. And the unreality of life, life that wants to go on forever and ever, but in fact doesn't really ever exist. This brief and vain recurrence, life, the cycle of life goes on and on. It is all meaningless. So Sri Aurobindo says this apparition is as if there's some remote God who doesn't care about the universe. And from his silence, which has no form, no name, he sent the shadow of himself, which is allowed to doom to nothingness the whole illusory universe, to cancel out all its show, its pretense of idea and act in time, and its imitation of eternity.
Is it death?
This is the character which Sri Aurobindo gives to what he calls death, yes. So that is to say, a power of dissolution, of negation, and a power that seems to deny the meaning, the significance, value, delight of everything here in our universe. That's what this power, which he calls death, represents. I said last time that Sri Aurobindo's presentation of death in the poem is different from the way that he's presented in the Mahabharata version. There he's given the name of the god of death, Yama, but he's essentially a necessary and even benevolent power, universal power, who keeps everything in its place and upholds Dharma, the right rule, the right law for each and everything in the universe. But we see that in the poem, Sri Aurobindo's opposing this power of death to the power that Savitri represents, the power of truth and light and above all, love.
You said he upholds the right law.
Mm.
Is it the divine law? Or
in
his own right.
Yama, as a god, he's also Dharma. No? He's the upholder of the right law of everything in the universe. That's his cosmic role. I'm just looking for a line in Canto 2. Sorry. Yes, but on page 12. In Canto 2, Sri Aurobindo is introducing us to Savitri and her mission. And at the bottom of page 12, it says, line 56, at colloquy of the original gods meeting upon the borders of the unknown, her soul's debate with embodied nothingness must be wrestled out on a dangerous dim background. Her being must confront its formless cause against the universe, weigh its single self on the bare peak where self is alone with naught, and life has no sense, and love no place to stand. She must plead her case upon extinction's verge. In the world's death cave, uphold life's helpless claim and vindicate her right to be and love. So that is a kind of presentation of the conflict which we are going to now see between Savitri and death. But what's very striking to me is that he calls this a colloquy, a conversation of the original gods, as if Savitri and death are the two original powers, or they are representing and expressing, and she is expressing, we can say, affirmation, the eternal yes, and he's expressing the eternal no.
May I contribute at this point?
Yes.
There's a link between what we have just read on page 12 and book 6, canto 2.
Yes.
The day may come when she must stand unhelped on the dangerous brink of the world's doom and hers, carrying the world's future on her lonely breast, carrying the human hope in a half-left soul to conquer or fail on that last desperate verge, alone and close to extinction's edge, her single greatness in that last dire scene. She must cross alone a perilous bridge in time and reach an apex of world destiny where all is won or all is lost for man.
And it's very interesting that these are almost the last words that Sri Aurobindo dictated,
yes,
before he left his body.
Which page?
This is on page, in my edition, 461. Book 2, canto?
No, it's book 6, canto 2, almost at the end. Page 461. At the top. Would you read it again, Sonia?
Yes. A day may come when she must stand unhelped on a dangerous brink of the world's doom and hers, carrying the world's future on her lonely breast, carrying the human hope in a heart-left soul, to conquer or fail on a last desperate verge, alone with death and close to extinction's edge, her single greatness in that last dire scene. She must cross alone a perilous bridge in time and reach an apex of world destiny where all is won or all is lost for man.
So why is it described as she's alone? What's happened to Sakura? He doesn't have to throw out the whole then he's dead in the sense of like no power, no consciousness, no presence, no support for her, nothing.
And that's why it's very significant that these are the last lines that Sri Aurobindo wrote, knowing that he's decided to leave his body and that this will be how the mother is going to have to face the universe and carry on their work. She will be the one who has to do it.
That use of the word alone, so and so, in this passage was criticized, was it not, being too much repetition of alone. But that's a not understanding the power of that word. It's like a bell ringing, a bell tolling, a warning bell.
Yes, and further down we've got alone she must conquer or alone must fail.
That's
so that she's carrying the whole destiny of this particular manifestation, or at least the destiny of this race. It's all on her shoulders.
On the top of this page, I have written a quotation from the Mother's Agenda of her experience, in which she uses the same image of walking on that razor edge between the precipice. She said, it gives the impression of a walk on a very narrow ridge between two precipices, using the same image. That's from the agenda of 15th January 1964.
For me, it's in the question, and I remember that there was a time in Mother's Agenda when she felt this alone, but later she had the communication with Sri Aurobindo again. So it seems Sri Aurobindo went in some darkness to clear something, and then later the connection or the work together was there.
That's a very interesting passage also in the agenda. I'm sorry, I can't give a year and date and page and all that. But she says, she speaks about the difference in the work when Sri Aurobindo was in the body. She said that he was doing everything. I had to keep him informed about how things are, and he was doing everything through me. But now he's not in the body, so I have to do both parts of the work. But basically it's the same thing. I have to inform him, look, Lord, it's like this, and then leave it to him to do the work. And now she is not in the body, and I think it's up to us to keep them informed. Look, Lord, look, Mother, it's like this. Please show us what we have to do. Because the work is going on. But she said, because Sri Aurobindo is there in the subtle position, he doesn't see things in and experience things in the way that we do here. Be part of our role. Yes, Soma.
See, I'm a very, very beginner to Mothers and Sri Aurobindo's works.
Louder, please.
I said I'm very, very new to Mothers and Sri Aurobindo's works. In this, what we see as death, the way you described it, it's condemning look, that look, I'm the only reality. If not using the word death because it sounds very scary, but that seems to be the reality of my Buddhist practice, because our very basis of Buddhism is that everything is impermanent and it is unreal. Everything, and like you said, takes away all the joy from living. Even the best things, the most joyful things, are still impermanent. So what is it beyond this? Like in it says that she fought this reality, and then
yes, I think this is an expression we can say. Richard Hartz has characterized this poem as the great affirmation, whereas there has been a very strong trend of spiritual practice, not only in the East but also in the West, that tells us, we read it in the Thursday class, no, that he who wants to seek God must leave the world.
Yes.
Yes.
No?
Yes.
Conciliation between these two.
Yes.
But Sri Aurobindo's view is completely different. He says, all this is the divine, and the divine has, the supreme has projected all this out of himself for the purpose of delight, and it's all real because the Lord is real and all this is the Lord, so it all has its reality. This is the big difference.
And this also
have a, yes, so of course this aspect of unreality has its place in Sri Aurobindo's yoga also, because although all this is real, we are seeing it and perceiving it through our mind and our senses, and that's not giving us the truth of how things really are. And that's why Savitri in her yoga had to pass through that state of complete mindlessness, loss of ego, in a state actually of not knowing anything except that there is a supreme reality. And then having the experience of that supreme reality showing itself to her as all the forms and movements and energies of this universe. Well, this is the role of the mother in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, that the supreme reality of this universe is that wonderful conscious power full of love and light which gives birth to everything, nourishes everything, is turning everything from its original unconsciousness into pure light and love and joy. And that the power that does that is the mother.
So this makes perfect sense that for some, at one point, she did have to leave the body consciousness and whatever.
Yes. To get rid of the illusions of the mind, to be able to see things bare and pure and as they really are. And then that brings the awareness of that there's some unknowable reality. So if we wait for that unknowable reality to express itself through us in the faith that it will that we will be expressing the truth, which thing will express its truth.
So the other, right, in a way they are taking the first step.
Yes.
And there have been mystics in every tradition who spoken beyond that, but of course their voice was ignored.
Yes. So it was also Sri Aurobindo's first major spiritual realization.
He's the only one who's talked and described such vivid detail beyond. Otherwise, in every other tradition we've seen up to this, that
Yes. And the mother he has also said, why is it like that? It's because we are mental beings. We work through the mind. And then when the mind comes into a level of consciousness where it can't grasp or articulate anything, it thinks that that is emptiness. It perceives it as emptiness. But he says it only has to wait, adjust a little bit, and it will realize that this emptiness is not empty at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's packed full of potentiality. And that potentiality is what all these potentialities are, what are getting manifested in the evolutionary movement of the manifestation.
I think that is important for me, an important point with the mind, because I perceived the oneness in nature from childhood on, and I think a lot of people have the experience of the presence, the oneness through nature. And the mother also said, and you open, you see that every plant, everything is aspiring for the sun to come down again and do the same. So I think that is, who worked with mind, everything, they had this only nati-nati and not the other part, which is so.
Like mindfulness and Zen, they talk about what you're talking about, is that being aware, so completely aware. One thing wanted to add, I read somewhere that this physical consciousness is limiting, very limiting, because we can't see.
So that's why we have to go beyond this mental perception, which interprets the sense impressions. Because we come from that origin, there's some part in us which can become consciousness with that consciousness, with that pure perception. That was what was described here now in Canto 6. A pure perception, that was the only thing that was left. And at first it all seems empty and mysterious, but then in Canto 7 there comes this. But to this pure perception, to the knowledge that she sees everything as the divine and herself as identified with the divine and everything. So this is the fulfillment. And this is the armory now, having had this amazing experience,
yeah,
that she's going to take with her now into this debate with death stretching over three books, in which it says, if every step and stage of her tapasya, of her search for her soul, each of her realizations, small and big, is going to be tested by this power of negation, this skeptic voice which doesn't believe in any of all this, which is denying all this. And then you will see in book 11, there's a very surprising denouement, which we won't talk about now. So, shall we read a little bit? It's already late. Huh? Book 9, the Book of Eternal Night, Canto 1, Towards the Black Void. Let's start now at the back. Josie, you want to start?
Was she left alone in the huge wood, surrounded by a dim, unthinking world, her husband's corpse on her forsaken breast, in her vast, silent spirit motionless, she measured not her loss with her helpless thoughts, nor rent with tears the marble seals of pain. She rose not yet to face the dreadful God. Over the body she loved, her soul leaned out in a great stillness without stir or voice, as if her mind had died with Satyavan. But still, the human heart in her beat on, aware still of his being near to hers, closely she clasped to her the new lifeless form, as though to guard the oneness they had been, and kept and keep the spirit still within its frame.
Thank you. Mita. I think you'll have to project your voice so everybody can hear you.
Then suddenly there came on her the change, which in tremendous moments of our lives can overtake sometimes the human soul and hold it up toward its luminous cross. The people is no more. Only the spirit sees and all is known. Then a calm power seated above our brows is seen, unshaken by our thoughts and deeds. Its stillness bears the voices of the world. Immobile, it moves nature, looks on life. It shapes immutably its far-seeing ends, untouched and tranquil amid error and tears, and measureless above our striving wills. Its gaze controls the turbulent whirl of things. To mate with the glory it sees, the spirit grows. The voice of life is tuned to infinite sound. The moments on great wings of lightning come, and godlike thoughts surprise the mind of earth. into the soul's splendor and intensity, a crescent of miraculous birth is tossed, whose horn of mystery floats in a bright void, as into a heaven of strength and silence thought is ravished. All this living mortal clay is seized, and in a swift and fiery flood of touches shaped by a harmonious unseen. A new sight comes, new voices in us form a body of the music of the gods. Immortal yearnings without name leap down, large quiverings of Godhead seeking run, and weave upon a puissant field of calm a high and lonely ecstasy of will.
Thank you. Tone.
This, in a moment's death, was born in her. Now to the limitless gaze disclosed that sees things barred from human thinking's earthly lids, the spirit who had hidden in nature's sword, out of his luminous nest within the worlds, like a vast fire, it climbed the skies of night. Thus were the cords of self-oblivion torn, like one who looks up to far heights she saw. Ancient and strong as on a windless summit, above her where she had worked in her lone mind, laboring apart in the soul tower of self, the source of all which she had seen or wrought, the proper
power
projected into cosmic space, the slow embodiment of the aeonic will, a starry fragment of the eternal truth, the passionate instrument of an unmoved power. A presence was there that filled the listening world. A central all assumed her boundless life. A sovereignty, a silence and a swiftness. One brooded over abysses. Who was she?
Thank you. Tara, will you read?
As in the choric row of unheard sounds, a force descended, trailing endless lines, linking time seconds to infinity. Illimitably, it girt the earth and her. It sank into her soul, and she was changed. Then, like a thought fulfilled by some great word, that mightiness assumed a single form. Her being's spaces quivered with its touch. It covered her as with immortal wings. On its lips the curve of the unuttered truth, a halo of distant lightning for its crown. It ended the mystic lotus on her head, a thousand petal cone of power and light, immortal leader of her mortality, doer of her works and fountain of her words, invulnerable by time, omnipotent. It stood above her, calm, immobile, mute.
No, thank you. Sorry, I was just pausing and wondering whether we should go on reading or whether we should first have a look at this first section.
Yeah.
You would like to look at the first section first? Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. Kyengye, you don't want to read, no? Chunhee, you would read? From the beginning, at the beginning of the canto.
Number one, born of a black coin. So was the Shulak alone in the huge room, surrounded by a dim and thinking world. Her husband's corpse on her forsaken wrist, in her vast, silent spirit motionless. She measured not her loss with the helpless thought, nor ran with the tears the marble series of pain. She rose as yet to face the faithful God. Over the body, she loved her soul, learned, leaned out. The great stillness without the stir or voice, as if her mind had died with the Satyavat. But still the human heart in her beats on, aware still of this being near to hers. Closely she clasped to her the mute lifeless form, as though the guide the oneness they had been, and keep the spirit still within his
hand. Hmm. Thank you. Anybody would like to share anything about these beautiful lines? Sona?
It says that as if her mind had died with Satyavan. In my life, I have seen that this process, this kind of numbness that comes over, it lasts for a couple of days, for many days when somebody very close died. I have observed myself doing everything, but in a very numb, robotic way, not even crying for many, many days after the incident.
So she measured not her loss with helpless thoughts. One is in a kind of state of shock. So these are very poignant lines. But at the same time, her heart, her loving heart, is still beating. Those feelings are still there. And with the heart, she's still aware that he's not far away. No? Aware still of his being near to hers. And so she's holding on to the body closely. She clasped to her. She knows this form is lifeless, but still she feels like holding on to it.
We don't even move that person's things. We don't even touch his wardrobe. We just
keep everything there.
Like
and we do that to guard, to protect the oneness that they had been. Now it's as if part of her has been separated, but they have been one, and she wants to hold on to that oneness as long as possible. And it's as if she can, feels as if she can keep Satyavan's spirit still within the body, in the physical form. That's the first reaction, very poignantly and precisely and compassionately described.
I see also another point. Over the body she loved, her soul leaned out. And this reminds me more that this is another point. The oneness would be this more human being stepping back. But this would be remind of this when the soul sees it, like yesterday and Friday in the talk he talked about sitting by the dead Dr. Nagpani. There is a joy of the soul. There could be another experience also. Not just hanging on the physical form, but on the with the soul and be one and connect, how we say, to connect with the soul or with the spirit. So I think there are several possibilities too.
There's also this line, she rose not yet to face the dreadful God.
Yeah.
I feel these first lines, she's going to be fairly human, I think, all of us. If someone passes away, that we really love, we will do this. The same thing. She's really human, as if she's forgotten of her potential.
But I feel that this line implies that she knows that she is going to have to face this God.
She didn't last.
And that this is the moment now when her mission is facing her.
Yes.
Yeah. So she's taking this brief moment, short moment, no?
She's filming.
To try or to maintain the spirit in the form, holding on to the form. But somehow there is the awareness that something else is going to come. And then something else happens. Mm-hmm. Suddenly there came on her the change. Larry, would you read?
Then suddenly there came on her the change, which in tremendous moments of our lives can overtake sometimes the human and hold it up towards its luminous source. The veil is torn. The thinker is no more. Only the spirit sees, and all is known. Then a calm power seated above our brows is seen, unshaken by our thoughts and deeds. Its stillness bears the voices of the world, immobile. It moves nature, looks on life. It shapes immutably its far-seeing ends. Untouched and tranquil amid error and tears, and measureless above our striving wills, its gaze controls the turbulent whirl of things.
Thank you. In the Life Divine class last week or the week before, we were reading about the lid above the mind, the veil, and how sometimes this can get opened up and there's a vision, a perception of something vast, infinite, boundless above. And in that passage, Sri Aurobindo said that this can come by aspiration, by practice, but he says sometimes it comes unexpectedly. And it came to him unexpectedly like that. In his first year in Baroda, he was in a traffic accident. He was riding in a horse carriage, and something startled the horse, and it bolted in that crowded street. Dreadful things could have happened, but he says he became aware that, you know, he became aware of this powerful presence above the brows up here, and that took charge. Nothing terrible happened, and he's written a sonnet about it. You know? He ends it with the moment ended, everything was as before. Only that deathless memory I bore. So that was long before he started practicing yoga, but it was one of the preparatory experiences which came to him.
Yeah, that's interesting, the two lines. The veil is torn, the thinker is no more.
Yes, the mind.
The spirit sees, right?
Yes,
that is
It seems that the focus shifts from being Savitri, having the experience of this sudden, there was this change that came on her in this tremendous moment of her life, and then it shifts to the our.
Yes.
Then a calm power seated above our brows.
Yes, very very nice, Paula. Thank you. So here, Sri Aurobindo's describing what happened to Savitri, but he's making a general statement.
Mm-hmm.
This is what can happen to anybody.
Yes.
And this is what it is like. You know? Something opens up and we become aware of this calm power above.
I'm intrigued by this line 25.
It moves nature, looks on life, and it shapes immutably its far-seen end. It shapes the end of life.
It shapes the aims, its purposes. What is that power aiming at? So in these moments, we see that that power can control nature, and it can shape things in ways that are favorable to the fulfillment of the purpose of the manifestation.
Yes.
It doesn't. It is immutable. It doesn't move, but while it's without moving, it shapes those far-seen results which it's aiming at. Mm-hmm. That's our true fate. You know, what the most divine part in us sees and wills. It's untouched and tranquil amid error and tears, all the things that go on. No? It's measureless above our striving wills. We think we want this and that, and we have to do this, the other. But its gaze, just by seeing what has to be, its gaze controls the turbulent whirl of things. And then he describes what that means for us individually. I think that's the next thing that comes. You like to read, Mum? Yeah.
The voice of life is tuned. To infinity sounds. The moment on grave winds of lightning came. And would like thoughts surprise the mind of God into the soul's splendor and intensity. A creation of miracles built.
Thank you.
What is the symbolism of horn of mystery in line 36?
Oh, well, it's referring to the previous line, the crescent, this crescent moon, which is going to grow. There hasn't been any moon. And then that little first horn comes. And that's a promise that there's going to be a full moon coming. So it's crescent means growing. That shape implies fulfillment. That's the symbol. But what he's saying, this is exactly also what we read in the Life Divine, that if once this opening has come, it may happen very gradually or more quickly, but what it signals the beginning of a spiritual change. So he says here that this comes because the spirit within, the individualized spirit, when it catches a glimpse from above, it wants to grow and mate with that glory. So it begins to grow, and the signs of its growth are that the voice of life gets tuned to another music, to infinite sounds. The moments seem to come with wings of bright illumination. God-like thoughts surprise the mind of earth. These things may start to come to us occasionally or more often. Because into the soul's splendor and intensity, this little first moon has been tossed in, and that horn of mystery, it's floating in a bright emptiness, but it's going to grow.
It's an incredible metaphor.
The mind becomes spontaneously silent, as if it's been carried away into a heaven of strength and silence. And the body itself gets seized. This living mortal clay is seized, and in a swift and fiery flood of touches, it gets shaped by a harmonist, an unseen harmonist, who's bringing everything into harmony. He's, in Life Divine we said, it's quietened, purified, refined, brought into harmony. So as a result of that, a new kind of seeing come, and it's as if we hear new voices in us shaping a body which corresponds to this harmony, the music of the gods. And we begin to feel the descent of immortal yearnings. We can't even put a name on these aspirations that come, these immortal yearnings. And the beginnings of waking up of divinity, large quiverings of Godhead are seeking, and they move around and they weave upon this powerful field of calm a high and lonely ecstasy of will. There's an intention, absolutely powerful, unmoving, unaffected by anything else. The beginning of spiritual transformation. Yes, Don.
Could you fit into what you just explained? Thought is ravished. Ravished is a violent word.
Yes, of course, Sri Aurobindo's using ravished in a symbolic sense. As perhaps we hear these stories, when I hear this word, I always think of the Greek myth of the rape of Ganymede. Zeus, the king of the gods. There's such a beautiful boy on earth, a young, beautiful boy. And Zeus comes down and just seizes him and carries him off to heaven to be his lover. So in a way, it's rape, it's violent. But when it's a god who comes down and ravishes you, in a sense, that's maybe the best thing that can possibly happen to you. Carries you out of your normal human state into a different condition altogether.
But when something is ravishing, that's very good.
When we say something's ravishing.
Yeah, that's true too. God is ravished, but still is ravished. Refers to
yes, so, yes, it's as if without the thought intending it, something seizes it, carries it off into these heavens of strength and silence.
So maybe thoughts are joined it all.
Your thought falls silent.
I think it implies that thought, our human thought is too weak. And unless it's forcibly seized, it's never going to reach
there. Yes, yes. Yeah, the thought is seized, and the body, even the body is seized. The living mortal clay is seized, and it all gets reshaped by this invisible harmonist.
This passage, the whole of this sort of beginning passage, is the fundamental change that we aspire to.
Yes.
And when I read, there's many passages like this, and this year for the first time I've had the sense that we are preoccupied as individuals with our little egos and all the rest of it with the idea of my yoga, my spiritual path, my experiences, my visions, and when that irrevocable change comes, you suddenly realize that there is a power that's come from within and is actually the same power that has created life, created mind, and now yearns to connect with itself. And that power is what's doing the yoga.
Hmm.
And this little ego, oh, me and my spiritual path, is somehow...
Yes, that's what
diminished.
That's what is shaping its far-seen ends, no? It is that power, and it's shaping its far-seen ends in each of us, and when we become aware of what it's doing, it can be very surprising and belittling to the ego, but thank God for that. What a blessing. I think we'll stop there for today. Now, I think there are three passages. No? If anybody hasn't seen the exhibition, it is open now and then we... Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.